into chemistry, but then I really wanted to understand how they work, and so that finally gravitated me towards physics. And so, you know, after all these years of being gradually becoming a scientist and going through all this stuff, well, you know, one of the things I really see is grace as part of discovery, because you're on that narrow road that you need to find the narrow path, the one that God is leading you on, and the road to failure and when you're at the forefront of science is wide, very wide, but that one little pathway that gets you from to a real discovery is a kind of, you don't know where it comes from. You just get an idea one day. I also realized that science is a powerful tool, but it's not, my intentions for getting involved with science was to go and come back to those philosophy teachers and beat them over the head with that. So I discovered, well, you know, science is, that's not really what science is for. So, and finally, I think much of it is an issue of worldviews. So if you start with a viewpoint that there is no God, there is no salvation, there is none of that kind of stuff, you start from that direction, kind of bottom up, and then the universe is basically ruled by molecules or fundamental particles. The other way would be that it's from top down, that God has made this universe and that the things in it have some properties about it. So that's a brief summary of where I am, where I came from, and where I am as a Christian at this point. So to get to the in protein structure prediction, they have something they call CASP, which is Critical Assessment of Techniques for Protein Structure Prediction, which is a kind of a challenge. And the best, I can't really explain how all the details about it, but usually what people do in order to succeed in this business is they use a kind of template model, which is that somebody has made an X-ray structure, X-ray crystallographic structure measurement, and they put a bunch of these together and string them up, and you get, by using sequence alignments of many, many different proteins, and then they come up with a structure from it. So none of the physics is used in much of that. Just a sequence alignment, basic bioinformatics techniques. The worst method for predicting protein structure is definitely thermodynamics. And my main area is actually RNA structure prediction, and there isn't even any CASP kind of approach on there. Essentially, the only way you can figure out an RNA structure is by experiment. And then you work backwards, going through some long stack of suboptimal structures that a program predicts by the thermodynamics. And there's a needle in that haystack, and that happens to be the one that you measured by experiment, and that was found by the so-called thermodynamics. So that is that's the status of the thermodynamics that we have. So why would I even do? That's the second time. Okay, where is that? Sorry about this. So why would I even bother to do it then? Well, you know what we learned in school. I mean, if Toyota can build a car, those engineers know accurately how to design that engine to get good performance. If you want to build a semiconductor, you need to know the performance of that thing. So the thermodynamics should work. I mean, it really should work. And another thing is, we need to develop our scientific intuition. I mean, why does a semiconductor work? Why is the performance one way or the other way? Why is the engine actually operating within certain thermodynamic parameters? It's also, by its very name, dynamics, it's talking about the motion of things. So CASP predicts structures, but those are the pretty little things in Nature magazine. They don't move, they don't do anything, they don't tell you how that protein is actually going to work. So for medical advances, this is the way you understand why proteins will fail, the Alzheimer's disease. Why do these things actually aggregate? You know, most of the people are asking why they aggregate, but any kind of chemist would go into the lab with a bunch of proteins and pour them into a flask, they find aggregation right away. So the question you really should be asking yourselves is, why do they not aggregate, actually? And that's what's another one of those amazing things about God's creation. And it's also important for actually developing some systematic way to fight things like HIV. Because if you really want to fight that thing, you got to figure out, one thing is the way it's going to evolve, because it's going to develop resistance. So, and the other thing is, if you know the dynamics of that retrovirus, you can throw a wrench into the system that will really shut it down. And that's what we don't know. The way that drug manufacturing works right now is, you got a completely dark thing out there. You got an enemy that's shooting at you, and you've got a gun and you're shooting back. And you don't know where that enemy is. And I guess the enemy doesn't know where you are, but in one sense, you're ducking the enemy because you don't want to get infected. And on the other sense, you're shooting just randomly out there. And imagine that, you know, okay, you hear somebody, or something. Well, then you start firing as fast as you can over in that direction, because that's all you can do. If you don't understand what you're doing, there's nothing you can do. And so that's the reason why I think you got to keep working at it. And so we can develop good treatments if we can develop the thermodynamics well. So about 10 years ago, I was trying to struggle with things, and I'm sorry, I can't really go into a lot of detail about it, but this is like a very simple kind of protein, and I'm describing the beta strands right here and how they come together, and there's rules for entropy for how these things would come together, because when you form order in a structure like this, these parts start to decrease the entropy. The loop areas are somewhat randomly structured, so these don't add so much order to the structure. It's mainly where you actually have some kind of correlation that you will get the order. And so if you have a good prediction approach, like, for example, you calculate protein secondary structure, which tells you where the beta strands are, and then you write some entropy approach to estimate which one of these is going to combine together, then you could use a MD simulation program. This was the original idea. And you link up the thing, and you gradually pull this thing together by unequal forces. So closer forces bringing the closer regions together more rapidly, and weaker forces gradually pulling the far regions of a stretched out sequence together. So that was the idea. Now most of my effort has been on RNA structure. So here I can actually show some the folding of tRNA. So this is the actual correct structure for the tRNA, and it's predicted as the most stable energy in my own approach. And basically this clover leaf, you have a D loop and an anticodon stem and a T loop and an acceptor stem, and that is the basic form of it. And if you go back up, go back in reverse and look at all the suboptimal structures that came along the way, you find that the stem gets shorter, and then eventually it loses a stem, and then you lose the interaction here. This is essentially describing the base pairing patterns of it. And then, this is offset here because I have to write in a rule for structures that have stem lengths that are rather too short. So they tend to be unstable, so it gets shifted up in this region here. And this axis is what I call a reaction coordinate, but this is a multidimensional system, so it's more like a kind of a projection of all the different structures that would fall down this free energy axis here. And so you get some structures that don't match up with the final structure here, but you see that some of the basic regions here are present in the initial structures here, and they get pushed out as this thing is gradually coming down. So there's a major driving force here, which they often protein structure people talk about the free energy surface being funnel shaped. This is basically what they mean, is that the free energy is gradually decreasing until you get to the minimum free energy here, and that should be your correct structure. And the program actually is able to calculate far more complicated structures, like this is a tetrahymena with rather complex domains in it and so forth. And it's actually able to predict them correctly, as opposed to the other programs, which get somewhat close. And the other thing is something they call riboswitches, which is these are two state systems. And the program has one aspect that's a little bit wrong with it right now, which is that I can only have one kind of stiffness for the structure. And so it's sort of like the old time in Russia where they would make only one kind of pair of pants, and then everybody had to wear that kind of pair of pants because that's what the manufacturer would make. I guess most of you don't. I know some of you know the old Soviet Union and some of the jokes about that. So anyway, that was one of the things that come. My program itself is not perfect there, but it turns out for this riboswitch system, this is what is called the terminator stem. This is the state when it's unbound. And then if you have a metabolite that actually binds to the system, then you get the unbound structure. And then these tend to have the anti-terminator stem on them and therefore actually this is the bound structure and this is the unbound. Bound structure. Yeah, that's right. What it basically is happening is that will turn off part of the genome from synthesizing. For example, this is methionine. It's a switch for methionine. So if it finds methionine as a residue, as an amino acid that's available, then it will shut down production of a particular gene as a result. This is in bacteria. And, of course, the energy differences are rather small, even though the structure goes through a rather large change. So it's making... You can have a switch, and you can have a metabolite bind to this system, I'm actually able to express the two states correctly with this approach. And finally, one of the most important things, one of the most interesting things, is that you get domain size out of this. This is a measure of the coarse grainedness of the structure, a lot of you aren't physicists. It means it's resolution, you might call it. It's similar to resolution. So if you look at it from far away, it looks like a blob. And if you look at it close, for example, a newspaper, if you look at it with a magnifying glass, you see lots of dots. If you look at it from far away, it looks like a picture. And so this, in polymers, you have some kind of measure that's measures the amount of monomers, and there's a certain amount of stiffness to it, which is kind of like its resolution. But it turns out that the majority, AU rich and GC rich here, the mid-range here basically has domain sizes that are on the order of 100 to 500 bases roughly. This defines a kind of a region of the structure. And so this is rather important in the sense that when you're folding, there's something that they call Leventhal's paradox, which says that if you have a structure that's 100 residues in size, then it would take far longer than the lifetime of the universe for this thing to fold. So I showed you first that I could get that slope for the funnel shape, but you realize that the changes in energy there are only a few kcals per mole. So it's a very weak kind of slope. Now, and you still have many, many conformations that are involved, so you can't overcome it with that. But I also mentioned coarse graining or resolution. Okay, now this starts to reduce the number of residues. So, for example, you start with 100. Now you can say that the resolution is 5. Then now you're down to, say, about 20. So instead of 10 to the 100, now you're down to 10 to the 20 as far as your, or say, okay, like cytochrome C is 100 residues, and you have three different conformations for it, so that's about 10 to the 47. And if you sample 10 to the minus 15 seconds on that, you still have about 10 to the 32 seconds that it'll take you for that thing to fold up. Okay, now we reduce the number of conformations down to 10 to the by a scale of five, so let's say we're now down to about 10 to the 20, 10 to the 10 to the 10. That's at least more reasonable, but actually, the other problem is now I can just give you a sequence that's 10 times longer or 5 times longer. Well, you still have the same amount of folding time for this system. So even reducing the number of degrees of freedom of your system doesn't guarantee that you will have it fold in a reasonable time. But when you have a limit on the size of the domain, then you have a domain folding separately in different places. So what I've shown then is that you can get the native state, that the landscape is basically funnel-shaped, and the entropy model can express some of the dynamics, like in the riboswitch system, and that you can predict maximum domain size. Now, how does that impact evolution and creationism? We've got not so much time. Well, okay, this is what my model predicts, and this is what the standard model predicts, a straight stick. Not tRNA, this one didn't even get the anticodon stem. Okay, and then this is another one. So tRNA with serine gets this part okay, but doesn't get the rest of it. Okay, I mean, it does sometimes predict things correctly, but you notice that these are two of the same thing. And so this system is very, very sensitive because the entropy model is not robust, it's very, very sensitive to any kind of minor change in the sequence, and everything is goofed up. So biology operating on this kind of way, this way, you make little changes and you get very little change. Here you make a little change and you get a big change. And if you look at what's actually happening there, I just kind of briefly describe here, this is describing the pairing. And so you get that same picture that I showed you earlier of the tRNA. Basically these two domains are completely stable at 10 kcals per mole from the minimum free energy. And this domain this region here is fairly stable and just a few differences along the way down. Whereas the standard model, it barely gets any of those structures anywhere when you search for suboptimal structures. So how does that reflect God's ingenuity? Well, we usually see structure through enthalpy, but God has been using entropy here to get us a proper answer. So we're always thinking about how do you put in something that locks this thing down? And God says, well, you know, we don't have to worry about that. Let's use something like, we can use entropy too for that kind of problem. It produces the dynamics, it creates all these functional structures, and I intentionally chose intelligent design there. We can build intelligent designs with that. Of course, God, by his infinite grace, has made a universe where we have the possibility of doing that. So the biopolymers are robust. We can make plans. We can actually design these things properly. And we don't have to, if we have related sequences, we can make some reasonable estimations on how to build stuff. And the domain sizes that have limits, well, this makes a search space. That also means the search space has natural limits. And functional RNA results from clustering in these kind of domains. And so, you know, it really comes down to how we appreciate God. So we can use entropy in engineering. I mean, think about things like the Viking lander. I mean, God designed a universe with chemicals that have rather interesting characteristics. And they can fold out into complicated carbon and nitrogen and various material things like that. So it's a little bit like maybe imagining the Viking lander as a kind of a as an example, or the International Space Station as a kind of modular system. So God thinks and has designed a universe, you might say, where internally there are things about it that can come together modularly as a kind of module and come together by natural means. And so that's a question about our expectations. You know, should it be waving the wand, or should it be kind of endowed creation in a sense? Well, by grace, I have developed a kind of a model that I think really works. And, you know, I don't say that, I by my own strength did it, but it's really by grace, I think, that I found those kind of things. And it's different from the model that other people have come up with here. So we have the atheists, and we have the, who've been saying, you know, you're wrong, the creationists, you're wrong, and the creationists are saying you're wrong, and everybody's been wrong, basically. So I guess the thing is, we really need to have some humility in everything we do in science. That's what I really like to say about it.